Well, good evening, everyone. My name is Rosemary Lister. I'm the Professor of Climate and Environmental Law here at Sydney Law School, and also the director of our centre, which is the Australian Centre for Climate and Environmental Law. So my colleagues and I have been following the climate change issues, particularly from a legal but also an interdisciplinary perspective, for many years. So I'm really very, very delighted to be able to welcome you here on behalf of Sydney Ideas to hear Clive Hamilton talk about his new book. Yesterday, you may have noticed that the Australian Climate Commission released its latest report called The Angry Summer, and it describes how in the 90 days of this past summer, 123 climate records were broken. And this includes the hottest summer ever and the most extreme ever daily rainfall event. So what we're seeing here and also in other parts of the world is consistent with the warnings that have been given us by scientists over decades and which are becoming only more insistent. We're expecting the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change to release its latest report in June this year. And I guess the question for all of us, and I'm sure it's why you're here, is to ask ourselves the question, how should humankind be responding to the extreme climate events and indeed disasters about which scientists are warning? Now, this evening we're going to hear from Clive Hamilton about how various scientific, engineering, economic, corporate, private, including Bill Gates and Richard Branson, military and government forces are converging to play God with the Earth's climate rather than commit to decarbonising the emissions by 90% by 2050 as the scientists are demanding. Now, as you read Earth Masters, some of you may have already done so, you will be gripped by a sense of disbelief. You'll want to tell yourselves that you are reading a page-turning airport novel. But of course, it is a very serious, fully referenced account of a technology which is bolting before its democratic, ethical, and regulatory parameters have been fully investigated and resolved. Well, how is it that the development and deployment of this type of technology is being regarded in some quarters as mandatory under international climate law? And I think that some part of that blame must fall on the irresponsibly slow international climate negotiations. So one may be tempted to draw some comfort from the latest negotiations in Doha in December last year, where two important decisions were taken. Going into Doha, all that developed and developing countries had agreed upon to replace the Kyoto Protocol, which in fact expired in December last year, were voluntary emissions reduction commitments. But at Doha, two decisions were taken. The first was that the Kyoto Protocol will be extended, and in fact, that second period commenced on the 1st of January this year. Now, under this agreement, developed countries have agreed to reduce their emissions by between 25 to 40% by 2020, which is what scientists have asked for. Unfortunately, however, Canada, Russia, and Japan have withdrawn from the protocol, and the US has never ratified it. So this leaves the developed economies of the EU, Australia, and Norway in the protocol, but these developed country emissions only represent 15% of global emissions. So what was the second decision? The second decision was to develop, and I'll read the words for you, a protocol or other legal instrument or an agreed outcome with legal force under the Climate Change Convention to come into effect on the 1st of January 2021. And this will cover both developed and developing country commitments. The text of this agreement has to be agreed to by December 2015. Well, I guess the question that many of you must be asking is, can we wait this long? The International Energy Agency warned us in December last year that their assessment of current commitments puts us on a pathway to a temperature increase of 3.6 degrees, and if emissions continue to rise, 6 degrees. Now, there's only a 5 degree temperature change between now and the last ice age. So I guess that the question is, are we left only with geoengineering? Is it our last hope? Well, Clive Hamilton is very well placed to take us on the geoengineering journey this evening. He is the Vice Chancellor's Chair and Professor of Public Ethics at Charles Sturt University in Canberra. He's been a visiting academic at the University of Oxford and Yale University. He was recently appointed to a statutory authority, the Climate Change Authority. He's a member of the Royal Society's Solar Radiation Management Governance Initiative, which he'll tell you about, and he's the author of a number of books, including Requiem for a Species. Please welcome Clive Hamilton to the podium.
Many thanks, Rosemary, for that introduction and the background, which is very helpful, and to Sydney Ideas for putting on this event. Well, climate scientists have watched with mounting alarm as carbon dioxide concentrations have increased relentlessly, and the anxiety has deepened each year as it's become clearer that the range of emission paths mapped out by experts in the late 1990s and early 2000s were unduly optimistic. We can see here that the coloured lines are the IPCC emission scenarios. You can see the one A1FI, which is the red one there, was kind of the worst case scenario, and the black dotted line is the actual growth in emissions, boosted, of course, by explosive growth in China. And so the actual growth of emissions in the 2000s has described a path that's worse than the worst-case scenario. And alarm has spread to staid organisations like the International Energy Agency. In 2011, it declared, on planned policies, rising fossil fuel use will lead to an irreversible and potentially catastrophic climate change. And late last year, a report by the World Bank, which of course has funded huge amounts of investments in fossil energy over the last decades, the World Bank warned that we're on track for a 4 degree centigrade warmer world marked by extreme heat waves, declining global food stocks, loss of ecosystems and biodiversity, and life-threatening sea level rise. Now, it's hard to communicate to the public what a world warmed by 4 degrees will be like, or even that the IEA and the World Bank should be taken seriously, although this kind of does the trick for me. After all, for many people, one unseasonable snowstorm is enough to nullify decades of scientific study. And psychologists have done experiments where they've got a whole bunch of people in a room and ask them about climate change and their beliefs, and when they take account of all the other factors that might influence their beliefs on the science of climate change, when people are asked, they find they're significantly more likely to agree that global warming is a proven fact if the psychologists turn up the thermostat in the room. So for at least a decade, climate scientists have been disturbed by the widening gap between the actions demanded by the evidence and those being implemented or even considered by the major polluting nations. At the same time, their work began to focus on the dangers of feedback effects in the climate system, that is, processes that amplify or dampen the direct warming effect of rising greenhouse gases. For example, as warming melts the Arctic ice cap, the exposed water is darker than the highly reflective ice that it replaces, and so the water absorbs more heat from the sun. And many in the expert community received a fright in 2005 and 2007 at the extent to which the Arctic sea ice retreated in summer. And of course, the melting of the sea ice this past northern summer set new records. The study of feedback effects has been closely related to another idea emerging in the scientific literature, that of tipping points. small changes. Here's a map to show the what are thought to be the potential tipping points, which might see the Earth's climate system rapidly shift from one state to another. So a tipping point, small changes in one element of the climate system might initially have only small effects, but a threshold point can be reached where it flips into a new state. And paleoclimatologists have discovered many instances in the Earth's geological record of the climate shifting abruptly from one state to another, at times within a few decades. The esteemed paleoclimatologist Wally Brocker has warned, "The paleoclimate record shouts out to us that, far from being self-stabilising, the Earth's climate system is an ornery beast which overreacts to even small nudges." Against this background, climate scientists began to talk about possible responses to a climate emergency, such as a massive methane release with rapid melting of permafrost, the collapse of the West Antarctic ice sheet, or rapid dieback of the Amazon forests. Any of these potentially could quickly shift the global climate to a new state, and once it happens, there'd be no going back. How, they asked, could we intervene to prevent these things happening? If Plan A, persuading the world to cut greenhouse gas emissions, is failing, shouldn't we have a Plan B? In the 1990s, proposals for geoengineering were regarded by the mainstream as fanciful and a distraction of the real task of carbon abatement. But the longer political leaders prevaricated, the louder the silence surrounding geoengineering became. And so in 2006, the eminent Dutch atmospheric scientist Paul Crutzen wrote an editorial essay calling on fellow scientists to begin researching Plan B.
So you can't hear up the back? Can you hear up the back? Yep, okay. Well, how's that?
That someone of Paul Crutzen's stature and undoubted commitment to protecting the natural world, he was described in Time magazine as the chief scientific caretaker of life on the planet, for his work on the ozone hole, that Crutzen should call for serious research into geoengineering as a response to climate change should give pause for thought. Geoengineering presents a profound dilemma for all those concerned about the environment. Many find repellent the idea, embodied in some geoengineering schemes, of taking control of and regulating the Earth's climate as a whole. It is, surely, the ultimate expression of humankind's technological arrogance. Yet, if the alternative is to stand back and watch humanity plunge the Earth into an era of irreversible and hostile climate change, what is one to do? By early 2009, 3 years after Paul Crutzen opened the floodgates, more than half of leading scientists who responded to a poll conducted by the Independent newspaper, agreed that, quote, "the situation is now so dire that we need a backup plan." Over half agreed with that, 54%. And that was before the Copenhagen fiasco. One third disagreed with the proposition, not because they assessed the situation differently, but because they believed that the better response is to commit more strongly to Plan A, cutting emissions. And so in the last few years, interest in research into various schemes to engineer the climate has been accelerating rapidly. Geoengineering may be defined as deliberate, large-scale intervention in the climate system designed to counter global warming or offset some of its effects. More than 40 schemes have been put forward, with some of them the subject of intensive research. and they're usually divided into two types. The first type is known as carbon dioxide removal methods, and I've illustrated three of them here. One is air capture. This is a mock-up of a sort of large bank of machines that suck air in and extract by simple chemical means the carbon dioxide from it, concentrate the carbon dioxide, and then pipe it to be buried using carbon sequestration technology somewhere under the ground, one hopes, permanently. The second is known as liming the ocean. The oceans, the upper layers of the oceans, absorb large amounts of carbon dioxide, well, it maintains an equilibrium, but as the oceans become more acidic, they absorb less of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. So the idea is to counteract the acidification of the oceans by spreading lime in the oceans and thereby assisting the oceans to absorb more carbon dioxide. And here's an example of the calcination of lime, which is what they do in the manufacture of cement. And the third carbon dioxide removal method is biochar, very popular, a lot of supporters. And essentially, biochar is created by burning or heating organic material of any type, really, in an anoxic environment, that is, without oxygen. It turns into charcoal. And this fixes the carbon very strongly in the biochar, which is then spread across paddocks or fields, and it helps moisture retention in the soil and stays stable for, one hopes, many hundreds of years. The second kind of geoengineering technology is known as solar radiation management. If the Earth is getting too hot, can we reduce the amount of sunlight reaching the Earth's surface and cool the planet that way? And various schemes have been proposed, painting roofs white to increase the Earth's albedo or reflectivity, reflecting more of the solar energy back into space, although there aren't enough roofs or indeed roads to paint white to really make much of a difference. A second is to install in space a large number, perhaps millions of very small mirrors at a particular geostationary orbit, which would reflect a proportion of incoming solar radiation, you know, around the Earth so that the Earth thereby is cooled. And a third, and actually a particularly interesting and important proposal of solar radiation management, is so-called marine cloud brightening. And this involves a fleet of specially created ships. This is just a mock-up, of course, spraying micro droplets of seawater into the air to aid the formation of low-lying marine clouds that would reflect some additional sunlight back into space. Some a quarter or a third of the world's oceans are covered in these low-lying cumulus marine clouds. But let me describe in a bit more detail what I think are the two leading proposals for geoengineering, and they are ocean iron fertilisation and sulphate aerosol spraying. Well, what about ocean iron fertilisation? Well, when we dig up and burn fossil carbon, we obviously extract the energy trapped in the coal or oil or natural gas. But of course, the carbon atoms, after we've extracted the energy, don't just disappear. They have to go somewhere. So where do they go? Well, first they go, of course, into the atmosphere as carbon dioxide. Some is then soaked up by vegetation. And some, sooner or later, ends up in the various layers of the oceans. And the deep ocean has the capacity to absorb very large amounts of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. And so, scientists think, it would help if we could get more carbon down to the deeps of the ocean and hope that it stays there. But how do we get carbon down to the deep ocean? Well, the answer lies, perhaps, in what is known as the biological pump. Tiny marine creatures known as phytoplankton grow by combining in the water, upper layers of the oceans, carbon dioxide, various minerals and sunlight to multiply into blooms, algal blooms. And on death, gravity causes the plankton to sink taking the carbon with them to the bottom of the ocean, where it's hoped it will accumulate and remain stable for centuries, thousands of years, hopefully. The effectiveness of the biological pump depends on the suitability of conditions for marine life, including the availability of micronutrients, especially iron. If a shortage of iron in some patch of ocean is limiting plankton growth, then perhaps the artificial addition of the missing ingredient can stimulate algal blooms, which will then take carbon dioxide out of the upper layers of the water, which will then absorb more CO2 from the atmosphere. Fertilising some areas of ocean with a kind of iron slurry does indeed induce algal blooms. But it turns out that much of the carbon fixed in the phytoplankton does not find its way to the ocean floor, but circulates in the surface waters, feeding the food chain, before being emitted as carbon dioxide back into the atmosphere. And while iron fertilisation stimulates biological productivity in one area, nutrient stealing can see it decline in others. As one expert said, you might make some of the ocean greener by iron enrichment, but you're going to make a lot of the ocean bluer. It's been estimated that a massive iron fertilisation effort over, say, 100 years could absorb perhaps 3% of the cumulative emissions from burning fossil fuels over the same period. In the meantime, ocean acidification and rising temperatures would reach a level at which algal populations could be, probably would be, severely reduced. And this is one reason why climate engineering without emission cuts would be disastrous. The Southern Ocean, huge ocean area surrounding the Antarctic, over which Australia has extensive jurisdiction. The Southern Ocean seems attractive as a site for accelerating the biological pump because the potential productivity due to high levels of macronutrients is constrained by low levels of iron, a micronutrient. But hopes that iron fertilisation could provide a substantial response to global warming waned in 2009 after the so-called LOHFEX experiment carried out in the Southern Ocean by a team of German and Indian scientists. They found that the biological pump only works well enough in oceans rich in silicon, because silicons are needed by a particularly effective kind of phytoplankton known as diatoms. Here they are, the little creatures here. And these diatoms are thought to be particularly useful as a type of photoplankton for absorbing carbon because they form hard glassy shells. And it means that the carbon trapped in them is more likely to find its way to the bottom of the ocean, and partly because diatoms are less favoured by predators and sink more quickly before they can dissolve back into the water. Now, most oceans do not have enough silicon to promote rapid diatom growth. So iron fertilisation would work best if targeted at the silicon-rich third of the Southern Ocean. Incidentally, the role of iron in the ocean is extremely interesting. There have been a couple of studies that have shown that in the paleoclimate record, the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has been reduced substantially. It's thought by a sort of natural enrichment of oceans, particularly in the Southern Ocean, due to dust storms blowing iron-enriched dust off South America and Patagonia into the Southern Ocean, leading to very large algal blooms which have taken carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and thereby cooled the planet. It's just by the by. The deployment of full-scale iron fertilisation, it's been estimated, in the Southern Ocean could be done, or the conditions seem to be suitable, in about a third of the Southern Ocean, which is around 5% of the Earth's surface. But if that were to happen, then that could serve as a sink for about a tenth of the world's excess carbon dioxide. So even if we exploited the Southern Ocean to its maximum potential as an area suitable for the kind of algal blooms that would work effectively over the long term, it could account, we think, it's thought at best, for about a tenth of the anticipated carbon dioxide emissions over this century. But the form of geoengineering most likely to be deployed is known as sulfate aerosol injection. Now, the proposal is to spray sulfur dioxide or sulfuric acid into the upper atmosphere, into the stratosphere, to form tiny particles, aerosols, that would reflect an extra 1 or 2% of incoming solar radiation back into space, thereby cooling the planet. The aim would be to mimic the effects of volcanoes. The particles spewed into the atmosphere by large volcanic eruptions have been known, for 100 years or so, to cool the planet by perhaps 1 or more degrees for perhaps up to a couple of years. These volcanic eruptions, large ones, also change the colour of the sky. They tend to make it whiter, except at sunsets and sunrises when they tend to produce very vivid red skies, particularly at sunsets, as you know, after a big bushfire, for example, the particulate matter in the atmosphere will give us particularly vivid sunsets. And in fact, in 1883, there were spectacular sunsets in Oslo after the eruption of Mount Krakatoa off the coast of Java. And these spectacular sunsets in Oslo were witnessed by the painter Edvard Munch, who wrote in his diary that he saw these sunsets and he felt a great scream emanate from nature. He went back to his studios and he painted the scream. Now, there are other stories about the impact of volcanic eruptions on artistic emanations. For example, in 1816, an enormous volcanic eruption, it's in the book, but I forget the name of it, Mount Toba, I think, again in the Indonesian archipelago, led to what was known, it occurred in 1815, but in 1816, a few months later in Europe, they had what was known as the year without a summer. And during that summer of 1816, a young woman named Mary Godwin, an 18-year-old, was holidaying in the Swiss Alps with a couple of friends, and they were going to go trekking for a couple of weeks, but the weather was so miserable, cold and wet this summer that they were constrained to stay indoors. And so one evening, they're getting a bit of cabin fever, so they set themselves the task of telling ghost stories. And Mary Godwin went to bed and had a dream, and she of a horror story. And she got up the next day and next evening told her friends, who were Lord Byron and Percy Bysshe Shelley, the story of Frankenstein. And of course, Mary Godwin, married Shelley and became Mary Shelley. The subtitle of Frankenstein is, Story of Prometheus. So the most likely delivery method for sulfate aerosol spraying is a fleet of customised high-flying aircraft fitted with tanks and special spraying equipment, although a hose suspended in the sky is also being investigated. In effect, humans would be installing a radiative shield between the Earth and the Sun, one that could be adjusted by those who control it to regulate the temperature of the Earth. Well, how effective would such a solar filter be in suppressing warming? And these are a pair of charts from one of the most cited studies, modelling studies, looking at the impact of solar radiation management through sulfate aerosol spraying. You can see in the top panel here The estimated warming of the globe, temperature change across the globe as a result of a doubling of carbon dioxide emissions, which is something we will get to on business as usual in a couple of decades, maybe three decades. And you can see it's hotter at the poles. And then they said, well, what happens in our model if we have this same level of global warming associated with a doubling of CO2, but we turn down the amount of sunlight, solar radiation, reaching the Earth by 1.84%. And you can see it largely neutralises the effect, the warming effect on the planet, although you've still got a degree or so, a degree, maybe 2 degrees, even at the poles. However, when you look at the impact of this kind of warming plus sulphate aerosol spraying, when you look at the impact on precipitation, on rainfall around the planet, the effects are much more uneven. And one of the concerns is that solar radiation management with global warming may shift the Indian monsoon, affecting food supplies for a very large number of people. Moreover, the solar shield, this kind of solar shield, would, as carbon dioxide emissions into the atmosphere increase, do nothing to offset the acidification of the oceans, as oceans absorb carbon dioxide from the atmosphere through an equilibration process. And against these kinds of modelling studies that show that it would be effective at offsetting global warming, other atmospheric scientists argue that the complexity of the climate system means that it's impossible to draw any firm conclusions about the consequences of such a radical intervention in the Earth system. They point out, for example, that the chemistry of the atmosphere, which isn't taken into account in these modelling studies, the chemistry is complicated. So turning down the amount of sunlight reaching the Earth in a model can actually give little clue as to what would happen in the actual climate system. One important question is how the extra sulphur compounds put into the stratosphere would interact with the ozone layer. The most comprehensive study concluded, and here these charts illustrate that, that in injecting enough sulphur into the stratosphere to suppress the warming associated with a doubling of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, a doubling of concentrations, would indeed deplete the ozone layer in polar regions, delaying the recovery of the Antarctic ozone hole by 30 to 70 years. Other studies indicate, as I suggested, that the Indian monsoon could be seriously disrupted, although the disruption could be less serious than may occur in a scenario of warming without the solar filter. Even so, our understanding of the influences on the monsoon is weak, and our knowledge of how global warming would change the monsoon is weaker, and trying to estimate the combined influence of warming and solar radiation management is little more than educated guesswork. Who knows what would happen to rainfall patterns? But if catastrophe ensued after sulphate spraying, at least we would know whom to blame. Or would we? And here we get to one of the strongest objections or risks with sulphate aerosol spraying. We cannot know how it would affect the global climate system through modelling or even by conducting experiments. Only by full-scale implementation could we get a clear idea of its impacts. Even then, it's estimated that we would need 10 years of data on the global climate before we had enough information to separate out the effects of sulphate aerosol spraying from natural variability and indeed from the effects of human-induced warming. The levels of omniscience and omnipotence required to make it work really would have us playing God. To compound the risks, if after 10 years, when we accumulated enough data to decide that our intervention was not a good idea, it may be impossible to terminate the solar shield. Why should this be so? Well, for some time, ecologists have known that the rate at which the globe warms is a greater threat to ecosystems than the amount of warming, because a slower rate of warming gives plants and ecosystems more time to adapt. At a warming rate of 0.3 degrees centigrade per decade, so a third of a degree per decade, it's been estimated only 30% of ecosystems can adapt. Now, according to one study, here in the upper chart, projected rates of warming, they're actually associated with a range of estimates of the so-called climate sensitivity. That's the extent to which the globe is estimated to warm as a result of doubling of carbon dioxide concentrations, and the usual estimate is 3 degrees. So take a kind of middle path here in this rainbow of possibilities in that upper panel. So that's the likely warming associated with business as usual through to the end of the century. What would happen, the scientist asked, if we imposed a solar shield, a sulfate aerosol shield in 2020, and kept it for 40 years, and then decided, for whatever reason, that we had to stop spraying sulfuric acid or whatever we're using into the upper atmosphere. Let's say there were some extreme unintended side effects, there was a global conflict, the technology failed for some reason, and we had to stop it. Well, what we see from this chart is the suppressed warming suddenly takes off. And in the first decade or two, you get an astonishing and disturbing rate of warming of the planet. In fact, in the first decade, you'd see a surge in average temperature by 1.3 degrees centigrade. And remember, I said that it's estimated separately that a one-third, 0.3 degree warming in a decade would see only 30% of ecosystems able to adapt. Few ecosystems could survive the first decade of rapid heating after the solar shield had been turned off. So once deployed, it's likely that we'd become dependent on our solar filter, the more so if we failed to take the opportunity while it was in place to cut greenhouse gas emissions sharply. And this, I think, is the solar filter's most dangerous drawback. Well, a constituency advocating investment in major research into geoengineering has now emerged and is gaining influence. At the centre of this network is a pair of influential North American scientists actively engaged in geoengineering research, and they are David Keith, a Harvard physicist, and Ken Caldera, an atmospheric scientist based at Stanford University. And just by way of a digression, but I think an important one, it's worth noting that Ken Caldera spent 10 years before he went to Stanford at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, the Cold War nuclear weapons research facility just outside San Francisco. And researching this book, Earth Masters, it occurred to me after several months that there's a disproportionate number of scientists engaged in geoengineering research in the United States that have links to the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, and that the worldview of Livermore seems to pervade some elements of the geoengineering research community. What is this worldview? Well, it's a technocratic rationalist worldview, confident of humanity's ability to use technology to control nature. It's a worldview that naturally privileges technical expertise and which, during the Cold War, fiercely opposed limits on its activities through nuclear test bans. At Livermore, Ken Caldera came under the influence of a legendary scientist known as Lowell Wood. He was a Cold War weaponeer, nicknamed Dr. Evil, a nickname in which he apparently revels. In 1997, Lowell Wood, co-authored with Edward Teller, and for those perhaps younger members of the audience, Edward Teller was an extremely important figure in post-war United States and indeed the world, who has been described as the father of the hydrogen bomb. Here he is patting one. He was the nuclear weapons scientist who was a very important architect of the Cold War. And he was, for example, often called upon to help the Pentagon choose targets in the Soviet Union on which the nuclear missiles would be deployed. And he was, Teller was the model for the Dr. Strangelove character in the famous movie of that name. Now, the interesting thing is that Lowell Wood co-authored with Edward Teller one of the first papers in 1997 advocating sulfate aerosol spraying as a response to global warming. And in, soon after this paper, in an opinion piece published in the Wall Street Journal, Edward Teller claimed that the jury is still out on global warming. He deplored what he called the, quote, all-out war on people who use fossil fuels. Instead, he wrote, "Let's play to our uniquely American strengths in innovation and technology to offset any global warming by the least costly means possible." In a follow-up paper a few years later, Teller and Wood argued that sulfate aerosol spraying is not only technologically easier, politically preferable, and environmentally benign, but it has large economic benefits, and we should be deploying the solar filter no matter what. The economic benefits would include a reduction in levels of skin cancer. For some years, David Keith and Ken Caldera have been Bill Gates' principal source of expert knowledge on climate change science. Gates was persuaded to commit several million dollars to finance research into geoengineering. And incidentally, Richard Branson is also promoting geoengineering as a response to climate change. If you go to his website, which he calls the Carbon War Room, you'll see what Branson is up to on geoengineering. There's a kind of messiah complex that pervades the whole thing. Bill Gates is now the world's leading financial supporter of geoengineering research. He's an investor in various geoengineering enterprises, including one called Silver Lining, a company pursuing marine cloud brightening methods. He's an investor in a company called Carbon Engineering Limited, a startup founded by David Keith to develop and commercialise air capture technology. Gates is also an investor in a firm known as Intellectual Ventures. Lowell Wood and Ken Caldera are associated with it as well. The company was founded and is led by a man called Nathan Myhrvold, formerly Chief Technology Officer at Microsoft. And the company has developed what it calls the Stratoshield, a hose suspended by balloons in the sky to deliver sulfate aerosols. And as you can see, the device is marketed as a practical, low-cost way to reverse catastrophic warming in the Arctic or the entire planet. If billionaires are destined to be the investors in geoengineering, then perhaps Bill Gates should be on top of our preferred list. Certainly, I think many of us would be much more anxious if it were the Koch brothers or Gina Rinehart. After all, Bill Gates' altruistic motives are well recognised through his laudable work with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And indeed, I was having a debate about geoengineering in Melbourne a week or so ago with Peter Singer, and Peter Singer said, well, what's wrong with Bill Gates? He's a good guy. You know, isn't he well motivated? Why are you worried, Clive? But the question here is not so much the motives a billionaire like Bill Gates might bring to geoengineering, not his motives, but his worldview that I think deserves some thought. Bill Gates has been dismissive of renewable energy and energy efficiency measures as solutions to global warming. He has dismissed solar energy as cute. With his background, he's inclined to see any roadblock as requiring a technological breakthrough. He said that what we need to solve climate change are energy miracles performed by, quote, crazy energy entrepreneurs. Yet we face a climate crisis not because we lack alternatives to fossil fuels, but because the political resolve to ensuring that they're taken up is absent for a variety of structural reasons, including the power of the fossil fuel lobby, the resistance of the public to changes in their consumption patterns. I mean, think how much Australian punters scream when petrol prices go up. And the widespread prevalence of various psychological strategies of evasion and denial of climate science. Gates and other entrepreneurs want to find a kind of killer app for what is a social and political problem. The kind of techno-fix mentality that's inclined to see planetary geoengineering as a way of cutting through the hard politics of emission reduction. In recent years, there's been a flurry of patents taken out over methods to engineer the climate. One of them, patented in the US, is so broad that if enforceable, it would place fertilisation of the oceans in the hands of one man. So we're approaching a situation in which international efforts to protect humanity from climate disaster could depend on whether or not one company wants to sell its intellectual property. Oil companies, anticipating a shift in the political landscape, are quietly backing research into geoengineering. Royal Dutch Shell is funding a study of liming the seas. The chief scientist at the oil giant BP was a convener of an expert meeting that, in 2009, produced an influential report on climate engineering as a response to climate emergencies. ExxonMobil, for years the principal funder of climate science disinformation, has inserted itself into climate engineering. The corporation's point man on geoengineering is named Haroon Keshki, who leads its global climate change program. In 1995, Keshki, when he was at the Lawrence Livermore Laboratories, was the first to propose liming the oceans as a means of reducing acidification. Through Keshki, Exxon has begun to influence various independent reports into geoengineering, including one prepared by NASA in 2007. Burgeoning commercial engagement in geoengineering is creating a constituency with an interest in more research and, eventually, deployment. Such a lobby is naturally predisposed to argue that pursuing emission cuts is unrealistic and politically infeasible, and therefore geoengineering is the sensible alternative. This is the slippery slope concern about researching geoengineering. Already, the chorus of demands for public funding is loud, and governments are beginning to show interest. China recently decided to include geoengineering among its earth science research priorities, initiating, I think, a marked shift in the international climate change landscape. It's fair to expect that if we reach the stage of deployment, any move to terminate it, due, for example, to evidence of unexpected environmental damage or perhaps international conflict, would be fought by the new industry with complaints of asset devaluation and job losses. Today it might seem absurd that factors like these should play a role in determining the fate of the entire planet, but the history of environmental policy making shows that these kinds of decisions are never based solely on scientific considerations. All of which points to perhaps the greatest risk of research into geoengineering. It will erode the incentive to cut emissions. In a political and commercial environment where cutting emissions appears too hard, geoengineering arrives as the next great white hope. Economists like the authors of Superfreakonomics have seized on it. Here you've got it, in the title, Global Cooling. It's all about solar radiation management. Why are we screwing around trying to cut carbon emissions? Let's just do it. That's what they argue, and in actually words cruder than those I just used. Already in the United States, right-wing think tanks like the American Enterprise Institute and indeed the Heartland Institute, which have for years promoted denial of climate science, are now advocating geoengineering as a substitute for cutting emissions. Geoengineering promises to turn a drastic failure of the free enterprise system into a triumph of human ingenuity. Instead of climate change being a vindication of environmentalist warnings, climate engineering exposes environmentalists' lack of faith in humanity. Instead of blaming technological hubris, the call is for greater mastery over nature. Which government would not be enticed by the techno-fix to beat all techno-fixes? Think about it. No need to take on powerful fossil fuel companies. No need to tax petrol and electricity. No need to ask consumers to change their lifestyles. And instead of global warming being proof of human failure, geoengineering could be humanity's finest hour. In short, while climate change threatens to destabilise the system, geoengineering promises to protect it. Yet beneath it all lies a gnawing question. What kind of beings have we become when we believe that we can use technology to take control of the climate system of the planet as a whole and regulate it to suit our needs for thousands of years to come? Faith in techno-fixes brings a distinctively American worldview to climate engineering. There is, of course, a long history of criticism of techno-fixes in the United States. Yet implicit faith in humanity's ability to overcome threats and master the environment defined the science as savior culture of that nation in the post-war decades. The Promethean ambition of planetary control, perhaps expressed most starkly by Lowell Wood, Dr. Evil, when he declared, "We've engineered every other environment we live in, why not the planet?" This Promethean ambition is harder to defend in Europe. In Western Europe, and especially Germany, geoengineering is regarded with more circumspection and anxiety. Even so, my guess is that China is the country most likely to be tempted to take control of the global climate. To finish, I'll just make this comment. It shouldn't be thought that those more anxious about global warming are always more likely to support climate engineering, just as it should not be thought that those who deny global warming science necessarily reject geoengineering. Yet among those who believe we should make preparations to engineer the climate, people like Paul Crutzen, there's a sharp division between those who see it as a way of defending the established order so that expansion, growth can continue uninterrupted, and those, I think Crutzen fits into this latter category, those who see it as a necessary evil, a regrettable means of protecting the deeper values now threatened by the consequences of endless expansion, the values of or the benefits of viable societies, vulnerable communities, ecological values, and indeed life itself. I believe that within the next decade, we will all be compelled to take a stance on geoengineering. The prospects are slim that the nations of the world will overcome their reluctance to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions sharply and begin what they should have begun a decade ago. As we feel the effects of a warming globe in ever more acute ways, the demand for a rapid response will become intense, perhaps irresistible. Managing the climate, one way or another, is humanity's great challenge for the 21st century. Just how confident are we that we can use technology to take control of and regulate the biggest and most complex ecosystem of them all? Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Clive. I think that we're all really deeply indebted to you for the amount of time that it must have taken to do the research and to bring together all of those with interests in this technology and to really put out some of the warnings about what might happen when, perhaps when it is deployed rather than if, who knows. I think a really important point that Clive has made as well is that each of us is going to need to take a stand on whether or not we support geoengineering or not. And it's certainly something which has come to the attention of our law centre here, as we've been invited by three separate law schools in the US to engage with them on a research project around the proper regulation of geoengineering. And I have to say that up to this point, we've declined the offer. Whether that's responsible or not, it's certainly something that we're not ready to jump into right now. So, as I say, up to each one of you in the audience to read the book and to form views. Well, it's now time for our question and answer session, which will go for about 15 to 20 minutes. And what I would ask you to do is to please, when you want to ask your question, is to make sure that you're speaking into the microphone. Following the Q&A, Clive will be signing copies of his book outside until about 8 o'clock. Okay, so questions.
Thank you. Thank you for your wonderful and extremely thorough talk.
Sorry, can you hear the questions at the back? No.
Hello? Testing? Testing.
Thank you for your wonderful talk. It was extremely thorough with all the details and telling us the dangers of geoengineering. My question really is to ask you about the position on this taken by various science academies, for example, the Royal Society and National Academy of Science in US and many other such institutions, because I feel if anyone can slow or even stop this, it would be a position taken by all of them, because from what you said, the geoengineering has some very big backers, formidable. So if you can throw some light about the position of the various science academies, thank you for that.
Yes. Yeah, there has been a strong interest in geoengineering research and governance, but particularly research, led by the Royal Society, but other organisations. I think the American Geophysical Union might have passed some kind of resolution on it. And, you know, I mean, scientists always like research. There's a sort of argument that, you know, more knowledge is always a good thing. But I think this is actually a bit of a simple-minded understanding. First of all, up until 2006, when Paul Crutzen wrote his famous article, which opened the floodgates, discussion of geoengineering or research into it amongst climate scientists was effectively taboo. So there was this kind of understanding amongst climate scientists that we shouldn't do research in geoengineering. And the reasons were exactly the same as the ones Rosemary hinted at. What does it mean politically to develop Plan B? It's not just a question of generating knowledge. Knowledge has power, knowledge leads to things. And so when people, and again, Peter Singer said this the other week, you know, he said, well, we should at least do the research. And, you know, I mean, that opens up so many, I mean, who is the we? And let's just focus on who is the we, who should do the research. Should it be Russ George, the rogue geoengineer who spread iron slurry against a whole range of protests in off the coast of Canada, wants to generate carbon credits from it? Should it be Yuri Israel, the eccentric, it's probably the least defamatory word I can use, scientist in Russia who's actually done some experiments on it? Should it be Richard Branson? Should it be done in private hands? Should it be done by the Pentagon? Should it be done in China? Should the Maldives be allowed to research geoengineering and deploy it? So I think before you say, we should at least do the research, you have to ask, well, who's going to do it? And who's going to regulate it? At the moment, there's no regulation of geoengineering research. And there is no international law that would prevent Richard Branson, for example, not that I'm suggesting he would do this, not too sure, sending up a fleet of aircraft to engage in sulfate aerosol spraying. There is no international legal instrument that prevents that. So until the question of until the regulatory regime is in place, including a level of confidence amongst the citizenry that those who are researching and developing this technology aren't going to become a powerful lobby and constituency that will have an interest, whether it's a scientific one, a personal one, a financial one, in seeing their technology deployed, even though the risks might be too high. Until all of those questions are answered, I don't think you can responsibly say, well, you scientists go off and do the research. I mean, the question of the process of generation of knowledge has a whole lot of traps in it. So that's why I think it can be naive of scientific academies to take the view that, well, we're scientists, trust us, all we're doing is generating knowledge, then it will be up to the decision makers to decide whether to deploy our technology.
Very clear, quoting many others, that humankind now faces grave existential challenges. In the face of those challenges, you advocated... active resistance, irrespective of legal constraint. The mobilisation, you said, of a mass movement against the elites and corporations that have captured governments and seek to maintain their profits through lies and obfuscations. I'm sure that a lot of people here share those views. I certainly do. But do you still hold those views? And how would you suggest that those here present might seek to put them into effect?
Well, thanks for the question. I think there are times in history when the question of civil disobedience has to be confronted in a serious way. And I know in the United States, 350.org, the organisation set up by Bill McKibben, has now embarked on a campaign of civil disobedience whereby substantial numbers of people gather outside the White House, refuse to move on, and large numbers of arrests have been made. And I think, and they're mostly older people, people like Gus Beth and James Hansen. Hansen's now been arrested several times, Hansen being one of the most eminent climate scientists around, one of the first to begin in the late 1980s warning about the impacts of climate change. And so, and in Australia, we've seen some small examples of it. Jonathan Moylan, for example, the young man, the anti-coal activist, who issued that hoax media release purportedly from ANZ Bank, which caused a problem on the stock exchange, and who is likely to be punished very severely. I mean, ASIC has been the subject of criticism from within the business establishment and the press for several years for a series of litigation failures, chasing corporate crooks and failing to succeed in their prosecutions. And so there is, I fear, that ASIC may be influenced by the demands of politicians, leader writers, and so on, that Jonathan Moylan, a 24-year-old coal activist with absolutely zero financial interest in manipulating the stock market, that he should be prosecuted to within the full force of the law, which includes 10 years jail, for an act of civil disobedience, for which a very strong moral case can be made. So I think this is a question that will increasingly come to the fore. And I know, talking to many young people involved in the environment movement, such as the Australian Youth Climate Coalition anti-coal activists in Melbourne that you know, this is something that they personally are thinking very hard about. Against that, you, of course, you have authorities in the states and indeed in federal parliament talking about passing, and indeed have already passed, draconian laws to protect energy assets from this kind of attempts to close them down or to disrupt them. So I think we're going into a period in Australian history where this kind of activity will be on the front pages quite often.
I'm going to argue by analogy. Seatbelts let you drive faster. Because we have seatbelts, there are some who argue that we shouldn't have speed limits because we have seatbelts. It seems that the issue that you are really aiming at is the forces or the powers of avarice versus those of social responsibility. My question is, being on the side of social responsibility, should we ban seatbelts?
Well, you know, we act as individuals and have certain freedoms, but you also, each of us are citizens. And as citizens, we make decisions through our governments to restrict collective freedoms in the collective interest and sometimes in the interests of individuals who aren't willing to take enough measures to protect their own health and well-being. And that's why we have seatbelt laws which compel people to adopt safer methods. I don't think there's any evidence that people drive faster because they wear seatbelts, and to the extent that they do, we have counteracting legislation which works against that. So, no, I don't think we should pass laws to abolish seatbelts. And I do think that we do need to act collectively to tackle global warming.
Yes. Your presentation tonight has concentrated on CO2. I just wonder what other chemicals are of interest here and might defeat any of the geoengineering. Particularly wonder about methane, which I understand from just public reading, it's a more dangerous gas for this performance, and that there's a greater amount of it coming from the melting of the permafrost.
Yes.
And what other chemicals also may defeat these current policies of geoengineering?
Yeah, thanks for that. Well, methane is a more potent greenhouse gas in the sense that it has some 21 times the global warming potential compared to carbon dioxide, but it's relatively short-lived in the atmosphere, whereas carbon dioxide persists in the atmosphere for centuries. In fact, some 20% of the CO2 molecules that you will put into the atmosphere when you drive home tonight, if you drive home tonight, 20% of those molecules will still be in the atmosphere in 1,000 years' time. And that's why carbon dioxide really matters. It's without doubt the dominant cause of global warming, particularly in the long term. Which isn't to say measures ought not to be taken to reduce emissions of methane and NO2 and other greenhouse gases, but there's no doubt that carbon dioxide is the principal one.
In terms of the carbon tax and the recent failures in ETS and such, do you think that this forward of denialism and an increased, just the sort of changeover from denialism to this, look at changing?
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of ways to tackle this question. Put it this way, in the 1950s, after the Second World War, Australia played a very important role in establishing the United Nations. And in the 50s, 60s and 70s, we Australians were very proud of the role that we played in the United Nations and a whole range of treaties and instruments that were developed by the United Nations. We contributed a whole range of UN organisations, human rights, or a whole range of them, poverty alleviation. And even though the Australian contribution was relatively small in financial terms, we felt that we needed to do this because we saw ourselves as good global citizens and as adopting a leading role in the global community. When the problem of climate change emerged in the 1990s, we started to hear a completely different kind of argument emerging in Australia that had rarely been heard before, coming from the Howard government in particular. And that was, we're small, our emissions are 2% of global emissions. If we reduce our emissions substantially, it won't make any difference to global warming, so therefore we shouldn't bother. And to me, this is the worst side of neoliberalism, the kind of selfish individualism that goes with a market economy spilling over into a market society. I'm ashamed to live in a country where our political leaders say, because we're small and our efforts won't make any substantial material difference, therefore we're going to do nothing. We're not going to be a beacon for the rest of the world. We're going to free ride on the efforts of other nations. It would be like Kerry Packer, the late lamented Kerry Packer, saying, look, you know, I might be the richest man in Australia, but, you know, my taxes amount to 0.01% of total tax collections in Australia. So if I don't pay my taxes, no one will really notice, so I won't bother. I mean, morally, it's exactly analogous. So I have no truck with this argument at all.
OK, we have time for two more questions, one there and one there.
I used to work for Greenpeace in 1989 and door knocking, raising funds for Greenpeace. I think it was very easy, brilliant, until the recession. And then nobody had any money to contribute to Greenpeace anymore. But even then, in 1990, early 90s, there was a book about global warming that came out, and that was very apocalyptic then. That was nearly a quarter of a century ago. And my question is, we do not seem to do anything until it's lapping around our feet.
Yes.
And doing something makes money, geoengineering. Doing nothing doesn't. So you geoengineers are always going to win. It's just what I'm saying. Look, don't get me wrong, I absolutely agree with you. The nexus of power, corporatism, corporatization, all the rest of it is inexorable and vile. But how much warning? What do we need?
Yes. Yeah, I think you've encapsulated the allure of geoengineering very well, and it's exactly because that kind of fear that I wrote the book. Because it's only by people, I mean, surveys have been done, not in Australia but elsewhere, asking people if they've heard of geoengineering, and around about 3 or 4% have heard of it. And so what that means is that it's kind of a blank slate. And the question now arises over the next 2, 3, 5, 10 years, how is, through the media, how is geoengineering going to be framed, or who is going to frame it? Is it going to be the scientists investigating it? Is it going to be the American Enterprise Institute? Is it going to be Bill Gates? What kind of framing? How is it going to be presented to the public? And, you know, you can see that I have a very different kind of framing to many of those involved. I'm not alone, of course. Yeah, that's why I wrote the book, so that the public can understand what it is, what are the forces behind it, what's at stake, and become engaged in the debate. But I do recognise the kind of problem you're talking about. I just, you know, climate change, when people have irrational fears, like they won't fly aeroplanes or they won't go on escalators. Some people are terrified of stepping onto an escalator. And there's a program, a device known as neuro-linguistic programming, I'm sure you've all heard of it, which is kind of a psychological strategy whereby we use our rational capabilities to conquer our irrational emotional responses. But with climate change, it's reversed. What we have to do is to use our rational capabilities to make ourselves feel afraid and anxious, to project ourselves forward 10 or 20 years, although you only have had gone through the last Australian summer, as the Climate Change Commission has just testified, to really, you know, to predict the kind of world that we're heading for. So climate change is actually a profound challenge to the whole Enlightenment project, you know, which imagined us as animal rationalis, the clever animal that could use its scientific understanding and its reasoning capability to foresee the future and to prepare for it in our own interests. And we're really seeing a breakdown in that. We're starting to understand that there are deeper psychological and social forces that will overrule the purity of the Enlightenment. And so, yes, that's why geoengineering comes along and responds to a kind of more basic set of instincts or incentives. And I think that's why I am responding to geoengineering in the way I am.
Okay, one final question there.
Thank you. There seems to be this trend in Australia and the UK and the US where the left, traditional left parties like Labour and here and in the UK and the Democrats in the US seem to be moving across almost to the point where they're becoming right-wing parties or sort of economic rationalist sort of type with economic rationalist agendas rather than more traditional ones. And I'm just seeing that as a challenge for issues of this critical nature, which seem to not get the attention they deserve, you know, because of the economic kind of agenda that the right-wing parties tend to prefer to pursue. So I'm just wondering, I mean, these are kind of extreme proposals which are necessary, but how do you get this across when we're having so much trouble just getting acceptance for climate? We're still struggling to get climate change science accepted here.
Yes.
And we're looking at, well, we've now got two right-leaning parties here, major parties, so it's not looking good in terms of getting any progress here in the immediate future.
Well, one of the... Yes, and one of the arguments that runs through Earthmasters is how geoengineering as a technological answer to climate change appeals to the kinds of presupposition and trends that neoliberalism over the last 20 years has given rise to. So, for example, it seems growth fetishism, which is now shared by the main political parties. You know, they compete with each other as to which will, you know, hasten the growth of GDP more effectively. That always comes first. Growth always comes before environmental protection, even something, you know, of an existential nature like climate change. The left, if you think about how to use the word nowadays about the ALP, but the ALP is more afraid of business than the coalition, as we saw with the mining tax debacle. And similarly, the whole trend towards individualism, which is particularly prevalent amongst young people. I mean, I can't tell you the number of times that young people have attended events like this and they say, I believe that we can solve this problem if we all do the right thing. So we should all, you know, change our cars and get public transport and so on and so forth. There's nothing wrong with doing that, but it's a mistake to believe that faced with a problem like this, individuals acting as consumers effectively will solve global warming. It's a collective problem that demands a collective solution. And yet it's protecting that whole system of individual freedoms, of the power of business, of the preeminence of GDP growth before all other objectives, that geoengineering seems to protect. Geoengineering comes along and says you can have all of these. We have a technological solution which avoids the need to impose restrictions on people in their energy consumption behaviour. It gives business free rein. It protects the fossil fuel industry. And it allows free market individualism. That's the great danger, I think, about geoengineering, and it's why I've noticed over the last year or so that in the United States there's a kind of immediate receptivity to the techno-fix embedded in geoengineering, whereas in Europe there's much greater scepticism. And I think as this debate unfolds in Australia, we will see both of those kinds of forces developing in Australia. It'll be interesting to see what happens if an Abbott government is elected in September, because I'm told that Greg Hunt, the opposition environment spokesman, and probably the next environment minister, is a big fan of geoengineering. Although, of course, he's not saying so in public, because any politician that says that, other than Newt Gingrich, who's very big on geoengineering, will be accused of wanting to shirk their responsibilities for cutting emissions. So that's something that warrants watching quite closely.
Well, that brings the proceedings to an end. I just want to say thank you to Meredith Hall of Sydney Ideas for putting on this event tonight. I think it's been a wonderful event. And also for us all once again to thank Clive for his insights into geoengineering.